Okay. 2 Samuel chapter 10. So we want to continue on here this morning. When we left off last week, we saw David doing this very gracious act on the part of Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth, and treated him really almost like a son of his own, and invited him to come and live with him there in the palace. He was crippled in both feet, so he was handicapped. Really didn't bring anything to David's realm or to David's kingdom that was of value, and so it really is a picture of grace, not of merit, and it was a very nice gesture on David's part, and was a nice place in his life to break off there. As we go along here in chapter 10, we get a little bit of a different tenor to what's going on here. In chapter 10, verse 1, now it happened afterwards that the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun his son became king in his place. The Ammonites are over here on the east side of the Jordan. Oops, this way. Kind of modern-day Jordan. They're over here, and the guy that used to be king over there has died now, and his son has taken over. And David said, well, I'll show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. Now, perhaps when David was running from Saul, this guy showed David some kindness. We don't know the exact detail behind this, but David felt inclined to try to show some kindness to the son who took over the kingdom of the Ammonites over there on the east side of the Jordan following the father's death. So he sent some of his servants to console him concerning his father. But when David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, do you think that David is honoring your father because he sent consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants to you in order to search out the city, to spy it out and overthrow it? So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. And when they told it to David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly humiliated. And the king said, stay at Jericho until your beards grow and then return. Now, if this isn't about the dumbest thing you're ever going to witness, I don't know what would be.
I think our news today is crazy.
David sends a delegation over to this guy to console him, to offer his condolences about his father's passing and so on. And as oftentimes the case with younger men, he listens to counsel that is not very good. His advisors accuse David of kind of trying to spy out the place. And so what does he do? He doesn't just reject them, he humiliates them. He can't just simply say to them, thanks but no thanks, going back to where he came from. He has to publicly humiliate these guys, David's delegation, by shaving off half of their beards. Now that would look good, wouldn't it? Jewish guys wear a full beard and have half of it shaved off and have your garment cut off at the hips so that you're not even covered from your waist down hardly. For part of that, both of these acts are about as degrading as you could come up with. It would be like El Presidente sending a delegation somewhere and they burned the flag in his face and rubbed his face in it. Quite a disgraceful, humiliating response to David's kind gesture to these guys. Now, this is just plain stupid. This is the kind of stuff you would expect out of the guy that runs North Korea. It's stupid. And so David tells him, well, just hang out there in Jericho for a while until your beard grows back out. Then you can kind of look normal again because they've been publicly humiliated. They apparently haven't been keeping up with current events to do this to David. This is about the baddest dude around, David is. And to pick a fight with him is just ignorance beyond understanding. But that's what they do. So when the sons of Ammon, this is these Jordanites over there, this guy in his realm, when they saw that they had become odious to David, the sons of Ammon sent and hired the Arameans of Beth-rehob and the Arameans of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob with 12,000 men. So what they've done is they've gone off and hired a bunch of mercenaries from up north here in Syria and around in this area, because now they realize, oh, we picked a fight with the wrong guy. We got to get some more military might in here because we've heard some things about this guy, and he is not too shabby. So they got to hire a bunch of mercenaries. So when David heard of it, he sent Joab, remember this is his nephew, in charge of his army, with all the army, the mighty men. In other words, he sends the best he's got. He sends the Navy SEALs and the Rangers and guys like that at him. And the sons of Ammon came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. Now, where this conflict is going to take place is, I'll use this map to kind of show you this. This is the city that's going to be involved up here. And what's happening here is that some of the people, some of the army from Ammon is going to be around the city, and some is going to be somewhere else out in here, and they're going to try to catch David and his guys kind of in between two and attack them from both directions. And when Joab saw the battle was set against him, that is, in that particular way, in front and in the rear, when he realized that this guy had split his troops up into two camps, one in front of him and one behind him, he selected from all the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans, these would be the guys in the north, and the remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. So David's army is now split likewise between these two camps, and one is going to attack the ones to the north, and one's going to attack the ones there by the city. This is Joab and his brother. Remember the two brothers that are left from David's three nephews, the other one got killed by Saul's commander. And they're kind of heading up the army here now. And he said, well, if the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall help me. That is, if on the northern front we kind of get ran over, you come and help me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I'll come and help you. So whoever is winning can kind of help the other guy. And we'll just split it up and go at it in that particular way. But notice that they do have the good sense to do this. Be strong and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. They place a conflict in the hands of God. These guys are smart enough to do that. That was a good move on their part. They basically said, well, let's be courageous. Let's go out there and fight the Lord's fights, but we'll leave it into his hands what happens here and just adjust to it as we go. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Arameans, and they fled before him. They hook them when they see David's army coming after them there. They flee on the northern front. And when the sons of Ammon, that's the guys down by the city there, saw that the Arameans had fled, they also fled before Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the sons of Ammon and came to Jerusalem. So what's happened here now is that David's army has come up here, and he's routed these guys, and some of them just flee back to the north, and the other ones flee into this fortified city here known as Rabbah. And it's a fortified city, so that you can't just walk into it. You got to knock the walls down. You've got to siege it and beat on the walls for 2 or 3 years with catapults and stuff like that to take it down. And so what's happened here is that basically the conflict has sort of ended here temporarily with Ammon's army in the city and the other guys fleeing. And so Joab then goes on back to Jerusalem. So when the Arameans saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together and had Hadadezer sent and brought out the Arameans who were beyond the river, and they came to Helam, and Shobach, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, led them. And when it was told David, he gathered all of Israel together and crossed the Jordan, and he came to Helam, and the Arameans arrayed themselves to meet David, and he fought against them. But the Arameans fled before Israel, and David killed, does your Bible say 700 or 7,000? 700? It's probably 7,000 because of 1 Chronicles. That tells us that it was actually 7,000 charioteers of the Arameans and 40,000 horsemen. He struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. So once again, David whips up on his adversaries. Now when all the king's servants of Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Arameans feared to help the sons of Ammon anymore. So David goes up there and mops the place up with these guys, and they realize, ooh, that was a mistake. We'll now serve this guy, and we're not going to allow ourselves to be hired as his enemies anymore. So it was a further victory for David, resulting in all of the blue that you see here. He's taken all of this territory around about because he's better than everybody else. He whips them every time. And so he has kind of put that all down, and everything has settled down and become quiet again now. So now, all that's, again, still pretty good. Narrative's going along pretty good. David's doing well, whipping up on his enemies, and things are looking quite good. Until we get to chapter 11. Major turn of events in chapter 11. It happened in the springtime, in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed at Jerusalem. So remember, these guys have taken refuge in this city, so David goes after them now, sends his army up here, but he stays back at home in Jerusalem. So his army is out there besieging that city, but instead of him being out there with them, he's back at the castle there in Jerusalem. Now, when evening came, David arose from his bed, and he walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful in appearance. Now, could it be helped that he happened to see her bathing from his rooftop? Well, she could have bathed inside. You don't have to be out on the sidewalk or wherever she was. Clearly his line of sight is down to where she is, and she probably knows this, does she not? And can she see? We're never told what her motives are in this particular situation, but one has got to wonder, why is she bathing outside when there's a line of sight above her that somebody could see her from? We don't know for sure. We're just speculating a little bit that maybe Bathsheba here has a little bit of an ulterior motive here. I mean, after all, is it all that bad to be married to the king? Maybe, maybe not, I don't know. So he sees her. Now, verse 3, he sent and inquired about the woman. Why is he inquiring about this woman? He's got 7 wives of his own. Does he need another woman? Remember, one of these wives that he's got, we know a little bit about her. We know about Abigail. She was beautiful, and she was smart. She was sensible. Why don't he go spend a little time with her and just let this situation alone?
Human nature.
Keep that thought in mind. We're going to come back to that in a little bit. What's going on here? He sends and inquires about the woman when he's got 7 other ones to deal with. And he finds out that this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Apparently Uriah was a proselyte to Judaism. He's a member of the camp, member of David's army. His background is Hittite. She might have been also. Bathsheba is probably a Hittite also. So he checks her out. He goes and makes inquiry and asks about her. And then David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her, and when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. So David sends for her, brings her into his castle, and has sex with her. James warns us about this kind of series of events, doesn't he? He says in James 1:13, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt by evil. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. What James warns us is that if we submit ourselves to these lustful impulses, they lead to sin, they lead to death. Sin begets sin. These situations are traps. They're snares that can suck us into them. Now, seeing her is one thing. One could say that's sort of an accident. Okay? A coinkydink. He just happens to look down and there she is. And if he turned around and walked back into the house and left it alone, realizing he's got seven other women to go choose from, his entire life would have been better from this point forward, because it's going to do nothing but go downhill from here. He's going to pay for this incident the rest of his life. This affair is going to cost him, and cost him dearly. He should have just let it go, but he didn't. He goes and finds out about her. He brings her into his palace, and he has sex with her, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant," verse 5. A classic example of what James is talking about. Following after our own lusts, and they're just snares that entrap us. And that's exactly what happened to David. Now, what is it about this guy that at times he's sort of the epitome of righteous living, godly living, courageous living? He's fighting God's battles, he's winning God's battles, God's blessing his life, and he's admirable. He's the kind of guy we would want to imitate. He's the kind of guy we'd like to know. And at other times, his behavior is like this. What explains that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde act? What's going on here? Why isn't he always like he was when he was slaying Goliath? Because he has a sin nature, doesn't he? He is a degenerate human being, like we all are, and he succumbs at times to that sin nature. Is it a powerful thing? It's going to ruin the rest of his life. He pursued it. He was the aggressor. She was just down there taking a bath, regardless of her motives. She did not come to him until he went and got her. He pursued this situation. And he's going to pay a very, very high price, because he has a sin nature and he succumbed to it, and it is powerful and it can ruin your life. He didn't always succumb to it, but he did here. So the situation has been laid. These kinds of things are, these affairs, if you want to call them that, I guess in his case it's a little different than in other cases, but they're always known. You can't hide these things. He had to send somebody for her. So somebody knows that she came into the palace. There's people around there that probably saw her coming and going and all that stuff. So no matter how much he may want to try to hide this, it's always known. It always is.
It grows and grows, too.
Yeah, we'll see that in just a minute. You're right. So, how does he deal with this sin? Does he stop at this point in time and confess it to God and seek God's forgiveness? No. He's going to layer some more sin on top of it. Then David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah came to him, David asked concerning his welfare of Joab and the people in the state of war. In other words, he acts like he wanted to talk to him to get an update on the war. That's just deceit. He's just blowing smoke at Uriah. And so David said to Uriah, "Well, go down to your house and wash your feet." And Uriah went out of the king's house, and a present from the king was sent out after him. David is trying to get Uriah to go home, spend the night with Bathsheba. Why is that? You can figure it out. He wants her pregnancy to appear to be the result of Uriah, not him. So he tries to corral the guy into his own house. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord and did not go down to his house. This guy's duty first, man. He says, "I'm not going to be involved in a battle with my men and be at home sleeping with my wife when everybody else is out here sleeping on these rocks on the ground. I'm part of this army. I'm going to share with them." So when they told David, saying Uriah did not go down to his house, David sent to Uriah, said to Uriah, "Have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house?" And Uriah said to David, "The ark of Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house, eat and drink, and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing." So Uriah is not only a dedicated soldier, He is extremely dedicated. He said, I'm not going to enjoy the benefits of a married life while me and the other soldiers and everybody are out here living in the rough. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to live like them. This guy is a class act. Uriah is a class act. David is not. So David said to Uriah, stay here today also, and tomorrow and I'll let you go. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Now David called him, and he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And in the evening went out to lie in his bed with his Lord's servants, but he did not go down to his house. Again, even in a drunken state, David can't get him to go home. Should have put a dog collar on him and drug him down there, I guess. He will not go home. So this plot of trying to deceive everybody, hide his sin from the realm, isn't working. They rarely do. Attempts to deceive rarely work. So he's adding to his sin the deception of his good friend and loyal soldier Uriah, and that ain't working. So it came about in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. Now, would you be proud at this point in time to have David as your friend? He's sending a death warrant for Uriah to Joab by Uriah. He's carrying his own death warrant. And of course, he wouldn't even think about looking at it. I'm sure it's sealed anyway. But that's cold. That's very, very cold. To plot the murder of someone and have them carry the plot to the executioner themselves. Who in the world wants David as their friend? And he had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front line of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. Remember, they're besieging this city over here. So what he's doing, he's going to send Uriah back over here, and he says to his nephew, Joab, the military commander, stick old Uriah up there someplace where the archers can get to him from that wall, and they'll kill him. So he might as well have just killed him himself. He's responsible for the man's death. So in addition to his adultery and his lying and his deceiving, he's now added murder. So it was when Joab kept watch on the city that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. That is, he knew there were some good guys on that wall there, some good archers on there that could nail him if he got out there in the open. And the men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. So he not only kills Uriah in this plot, he kills some other guys that Joab sent out there to approach the wall, kind of like you would normally do, let's say, knowing that the intention all along was to make sure Uriah gets killed. But there's some more guys get killed because of this guy. So his murder is not just of Uriah. It's of some other guys too. We don't know how many, but multiple deaths. So then Joab sent and reported to David all the events of the war, and he charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling all the events of the war to the king, if it happens that the king's wrath rises and he says to you, why did you go so near the city to fight? Do you not know that they would shoot you from the wall? Who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal-sheth? Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did you go near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. So when the messenger comes and tells David, and David says, how stupid was that, Joab, to send these guys out there to where they could be reached by the archers? You know you can't get near a wall of a besieged city. Some woman killed somebody they knew by throwing a stone down and hitting him in the head. That the messenger is to say, David, Uriah is also dead. That's why we sent them out there. So what looks like a stupid military move is exactly what David told Joab to do. And Joab knew that David would question what the heck had happened there. So he tells him that it was in order to put Uriah in a vulnerable place where he can then be killed. So the messenger departed and came and reported to David all that Joab had sent to him. And the messenger said to David, the men prevailed against us. We came out against us in the field, but we pressed them as far as the entrance of the gate. In other words, they came out, we pushed them back. Moreover, the archers shot at your servants from the wall, so that some of the king's servants are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. So the message came that his plot was actually successful. He did indeed get Uriah killed, along with some other innocent parties. And so, to his other sins, he added now murder. So David said to the messenger, "Thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as another. Make your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it." And so encouraged him. So, Joab, don't be concerned about all this. He probably figured this out by now anyway. Now, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. When the time of mourning was over, David sent and brought her into his house, and she became his wife. Then she bore him a son. But the thing that David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. I guess so. He may think he's fooled a lot of the palace residents or other people of that sort, but you can never fool God with this kind of stuff. These kinds of illicit affairs are always known to God, usually known to man. And so God was not happy with David, and we'll see what happens from here forward. But do you understand the scene so far? Got the situation in mind? This city that they were involved in before has become a besieged city, and he used that siege process to get Uriah in a position where he would be killed by the enemy's army. So this dedicated, devoted soldier who won't even comfort himself by going home when the battle is on, he's now dead because of David. This guy who slew Goliath by faithful obedience to the word of God has now reduced himself to lying, adultery, deceiving, murder. I mean, there ain't much left, is there? And it really illustrates how awesome the sin nature of man is. How it can take us from a pinnacle of righteous behavior and conduct, we saw as exhibiting grace to Mephibosheth and all that kind of stuff, to this. I mean, this is horrible. This is as bad a storyline as you find in Scripture about anywhere. And it shows you how utterly powerful the sin nature of man is. So, things didn't go too well for David. He's about 50 years old now. I mean, this ain't 18-year-old with his hormones running amok. This is a 50-year-old man with seven other wives pulling this kind of a stunt and trying to cover it by killing his trusted soldier. Well, let's see how this all works out. Maybe he got away with it. Maybe his attempts to deceive worked. So then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, remember, Nathan is the prophet now. He's kind of God's spokesman to the nation, to the realm. So he's going to speak through Nathan to David. So he sends Nathan, and Nathan probably had to sit and think through, now how am I going to approach this? How am I going to tell this guy what the Lord wants me to tell him? Because if I get him too mad at me, he might chop my head off and not hear the punchline. So he comes up with a story, an analogy. Here's the analogy. There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had great many flocks and herds. Who's the rich man in this story? David. But the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb. Who's the poor man? Uriah. Who's the poor man. Who's the ewe lamb? Bathsheba, right? And he bought and nourished it and grew it up together with him and his children, and it would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd. What's his own herd there? Those seven wives, right? He was unwilling to take from one of them to prepare the wayfarer who had come to him, but he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. He took the only thing this one guy had that was of any value, rather than using his own resources, and he took that from the guy. And when David hears that story, verse 5, he was mad as a dickens against that guy. He said, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this also deserves to die. He gets the storyline, the picture, quite correctly and concludes quite correctly that whoever would do something like that deserves to die. And he must make restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion. Then Nathan said to him, David, you are the man. You're the rich man that took the ewe lamb from Uriah instead of using your own resources. You're the guy that deserves to die, as you correctly concluded. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if that had been too little for you, I would have added to you many more things like these. David, all that you have I gave to you, and if that hadn't been enough, if you'd wanted more, I would have given you more. But I gave you the kingdom and all of the bennies that go along with it. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You've struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword. Oh, I guess his deceits didn't work out too well, did it? God knew exactly what happened. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the word, with the sword of the sons of Ammon. So God knew exactly what went on here. You may be able to hide these affairs from men, but you're not going to hide them from God. God knew everything that went on here, of course. And he's now been confronted with that. And here's the result. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house. David's household is going to experience death, abnormal death. Death as a result of the sword, not sickness or illness necessarily, but from the sword. Beg your pardon?
It still lives.
To a certain degree, something still is going on there. Because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you from your own household. This peaceful, happy household that existed before David sins for Bathsheba is going to become constant turmoil now. I will even take your wives before your eyes and give them to your companion, and he shall lie with your wives in broad daylight. Indeed, you did it in secret, but I will do this thing before all Israel and under the sun. The disgrace that David is going to bear, the humiliation that he's going to bear because of this lustful encounter, will be publicly known. He didn't get away with it at all. People are going to know about it. They're going to ridicule him, and he's going to be disgraced. So all of his conniving, all of his plotting, all of his dealing to try to hide this has come to no avail at all. God knows about it, and he's going to punish him for it, and it's going to be a punishment that he has to endure the rest of his life. 50-year-old guy. Lives to maybe about 80. Another 30 years, he's going to have to live with the consequences of this. Nothing but selfish, lustful behavior on his part. There is no excuse for it whatsoever. And yet he chose that course of action, and he's now going to pay. But he does understand Nathan's message, and he does respond properly in verse 13. He says to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has taken away your sin. You shall not die. That is, the Lord has forgiven him for this. He's not going to take his life as a result of it. But his conclusion is correct. He has indeed sinned against the Lord. However, because by this deed you have given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die. Now, if that verse doesn't cause you any pause whatsoever, you're a lot better theologian than I am. Why is the infant paying for David and Bathsheba's sin? Why is the infant going to die? Did the infant do anything? This is one of those verses in Scripture that cause us to kind of choke up a little bit. It's not easy to explain. Remember in John chapter 9, the Lord and a couple of his disciples encounter this guy born blind from birth, and they say, well, who sinned, this guy or his parents? It's got to be one of those three, guys. And the Lord said, no, it's not one of those three. It's not the guy born blind, and it's not his parents. It's in order that God's will, a work of God, may be done through that person's life. And so you look at that situation, you say, well, now, wait a minute. Being born blind from birth so that the work of God can be revealed in some way to man? That's fair and reasonable? That's just? And we take our concepts and our standard of morality and our ethics and our idea of what God ought to be like, and we say, this doesn't fit too well. I'm having a little trouble getting all these pieces to come together here exactly to explain all of this. And we really come away with a little bit lacking. We don't quite get the understanding that we want. And the problem is that we're trying to put an infinite being into our finite concepts of fairness and righteousness and judgment and what should be done and all this sort of stuff. And it can't be done. There are times, a lot of times it can be done because God tells us enough that we can do it. He gives us rules and principles of life and things that He will do that we can kind of get our minds around those and properly understand Him. But occasionally we encounter something like this and we can't quite come up with the total answer we'd like to come up with. We have to go back to the principle the Lord stated here. This happened in order that a work of God could be done. There are greater things going on in the universe, in the realm of mankind, than we can necessarily fully understand at all times. The death of this child, I think, is in that category. It's a work that God is going to do that may be beyond our abilities to grasp totally with our mind. Look at some of the indicators he said here, though. He says, by this deed you've given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. If this child had lived and was walking around every day, would he not be a public testimony to the sin of David and Bathsheba that in essence went unpunished? They got away with it? Here's a healthy young man growing up and doing just fine, and his parents got him here because they involved themselves in lust, sin, lying, cheat, stealing, murder. Is that a testimony that you think God might want to leave to His nation about Himself, that goes unpunished, that goes tolerated? He says, no. I'm going to, and by the way, what would the child think of himself every day? What would his self-esteem be like, knowing that he was the product of an adulterous, lying, cheating, stealing, murdering relationship? He probably wouldn't think real high of himself, would he? So there's an aspect of grace seen in this, in that the child doesn't have to live with that. The testimony concerning the will of God for his children is not distorted and misrepresented by this living child. And things like that then seem to be at the base of our understanding here as best that we can come up with something. So Nathan went off to his house, and the Lord struck the child and Uriah's widow bore to David, so that he was very sick. So clearly this disease, this ailment that comes upon the child is at the Lord's hand. Now, the relationships have consequences. This one was not good. The consequences of this relationship was not good. So this child is born, but he is sick. So David therefore inquired of God for the child, and David fasted and went and laid on all night on the ground. So clearly the child is loved by David and his mother, and they're praying for him. He's kind of fasting and refusing to take normal comforts. He's laying on the ground. And the elders of his household stood beside him in order to raise him up from the ground, but he was unwilling and would not eat food with them. They just cannot comfort him. He is so upset over this child's illness. But Nathan told him, what was going to happen. Then it happened on the seventh day that the child died. So it lingered with this illness, this sickness, for 7 days, and he died. And all the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, behold, while he was a child was alive, we spoke to him, and he wouldn't listen to our voice. Now then, how can we tell him that the child is dead, since he might do himself harm? He was so depressed that they were worried that by giving him this news, now he might kill himself. But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, David perceived that the child was dead. So David said to his servants, is the child dead? And they said, he is dead. So he now knows the outcome of this illness, that the child has died. So David arose from the ground, washed, anointed himself, changed his clothes, came into the house of the Lord and worshiped. Then he came to his own house, and when he requested, they set food before him, and he ate. And his servant said, well, what is this thing that you've done? While the child was alive, you fasted and wept, but when the child died, you arose and ate food. And he said this, while the child was alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who knows, maybe the Lord will be gracious to me and the child may live. But now he has died, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. Now David has an understanding about this child's life that is of interest, I think, to any parent that has ever been, and that is that the death of an infant, or the death of any child, say, before the age of accountability, which probably varies for each of us, but it's around 12, 13, it's around adolescence, and there's an example in Isaiah that kind of gives that indication, but, you know, for girls it may be a little sooner, for boys a little later, but, you know, somewhere in that range. If the child dies before the age of accountability, it looks like, from this principle here, that the Lord takes them to heaven with himself, that they're saved, they're eternally secure. The verse doesn't expand on that concept, but that looks like the case from what he says here. David knew that he would rejoin this child at some point in time when he died. And it's not necessarily a treatise on the redemption of infant children. It's a recognition of the fact that he too is going to die, like this child died, but they would be together again someday. So my opinion, my understanding of Scripture is that any child who dies before reaching that age, where he does not know the issues of right and wrong in life and death, eternal life and death, that they're safe and secure with the Lord. Again, this is about all we got to hang our hats on. Here's this one verse, but I think that's what we can conclude from that. So, if you've lost a child in infancy, you will see them again. Mothers who have miscarried, you will see them again. Even up to the age of adolescence, I think you can rely on seeing them again, and that's his conclusion about this child. So his affair now has cost him a child, and it will be more. This is not the only child that he's going to lose. The price of this affair was extremely high. So David then, verse 24, David comforted his wife Bathsheba and went into her and lay with her, and she gave birth to a son, and she named him Solomon. Ever heard that name before? This is child number two of David and Bathsheba, Solomon. And the Lord loved him and sent word through Nathan the prophet and named him Jedidiah for the Lord's sake. Jedidiah means beloved of the Lord, and that's what the Lord named him. David and Bathsheba named him Solomon, but God named him Jedidiah. And Old Testament names nearly always reflect character and God's relationship to that character, and that's the case here. So, it was only the first son that died, not the second. So now, back to the battle. Joab fought against Rabbah of the sons of Ammon and captured the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Rabbah, I have even captured the city of waters. Now therefore, gather the rest of the people together and camp against the city and capture it, lest I capture the city myself and it be named after me. So now, if David had been over there where he should have been in the first place, besieging this city, maybe none of this would have happened. And isn't that always the case? it's these old idle hand type deal, you know, idle hands of devil's workshop type deal. It seems like when you have time on your hands and are not occupied with things, that's when you get into trouble. That's when you start messing around with things or people that you shouldn't, and that's when you get into trouble. So he should have been over here, but Joab was there, and he finally broke the city down, and he said, look, I got this place taken over, David. Come on over here yourself and claim it, or I'm going to finish up, and they'll name it after me instead of you. So get over here if you want this deal. So David gathered all the people, and he went to Rabbah and fought against it, and he captured it, and he took the crown of their king from his head, and its weight was a talent of gold. That's about 75 pounds. That's a hunk of gold, isn't it? How are you going to walk around with 75 pounds on your head? You'd have neck trouble within about 15 minutes of putting that sucker on, wouldn't you? At any rate, they got it. And in it was a precious stone. And it was placed on David's head, and he became 3 inches shorter than he was before. And he brought out the spoil of the city in great amounts. I used to be 6 feet tall when I was in high school. I'm 5'11 now. Nothing but time. Just shrunk, you know, just the old spinal column just shrinks down over time. You couldn't put this kind of weight on your head and survive it all. So he brought out the people who were in it and set them under Saul's sharp iron instruments and iron axes and made them pass through the brick kiln. And thus he did to all the cities of the sons of Ammon. Then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. Now, exactly what he did there in verse 31 is hard to tell. You can interpret it in a couple different ways. One way is he actually killed these people with the same sort of cruel methodology that they used, saw them up and stuff like that. Or the other method is that he put them to work in those areas doing those kinds of things, sawing lumber, working the brick kilns and things like that. So not sure which is the correct understanding there, but at any rate, these guys are now captive people. So he kind of mopped up and went on back to Jerusalem. This whole battle scene would have been better if he'd have been involved in it instead of being at home at the palace mucking around with someone he had no business mucking around with. But he didn't. He gave Satan an opportunity. Remember Joseph? He had a similar opportunity, didn't he? Potiphar's wife was all over him like a cheap suit, like mine. But he ran, he fled. He left his garment behind. He got the heck out of Dodge. And instead, David runs to her instead of the other way. So Joseph handled the temptation or the unfortunate encounter correctly. David did not. And he isn't through paying for it by any means. We're just getting into, remember God said he's going to put a sword in his household. And we'll see that sword at work as we go on from here. So a man that at times is on the pinnacle of righteous behavior and conduct and is most admirable, he is an epitome of godly living, of living by faith. And at other times, he is a despicable rat, as we've seen him be here this morning. When did the prodigal son stop being his father's son? He never stopped being his father's son, did he? He was a bum too. He's over eating, you know, spending all his money on wine, women, and song, and ends up eating out of pig troughs because that's all he could come up with. But did he ever stop being his father's son? No. Did David ever stop being his father's son? No. God never withdrew his love for him like he did Saul. That was not his end, like it was Saul's, but he sure did pay a horrible price for his sinful behavior, and we just saw one instance of that. We're going to see more. There's some more things going to go on here that are about as bad as what we've seen here. Any questions or comments about anything we've seen in his life so far? Can you find yourself somewhere between the extremes of his life, slaying Goliath and this kind of stuff going on here? Most of us live somewhere in between there, don't we? Hopefully we live a little closer toward the slaying of Goliath than we do this other stuff, but our lives will fit in that continuum somewhere, and hopefully we will strive for it to be down there on the let's slay Goliath in instead of this other stuff. Any other questions or comments before we roll? Okay, we'll get you more information about a Christmas date deal and talk about that more as time goes on, but kind of plan on something in that time frame. One of the Saturdays early in December probably will work out, so we'll get into that later. I'll let you go. Have a good week. We'll see you next Sunday, Lord willing.